Live from the Ken and Valerie Baker studio at WHYY, this is Studio 2.
Thank you, Eddie C., and welcome to the show. I'm Avi Wolfman-Arendt.
And I'm Kevin McCrory in for Cherry Gregg. Today on the show, Avi, we're doing a roundup of kind of the economics news, what's going on in the economy, all the uncertainty with the war in Iran, yet the stock market is surging. What's going on there? Meanwhile, American consumer confidence is hitting an all-time low. You've got the affordability crisis continuing and signs that, you know, inflation is stubborn to the point that it's still eating away at the raises people are getting in their jobs. So we're trying to unpack all of that, plus Donald Trump, President Trump's pick for the Fed has a confirmation hearing tomorrow. We want to get a sense of who this Kevin Warsh is. What is he about, and what could that mean for the independence of the Fed?
Well, Kevin's talking about Kevin. Should be good stuff. A question for you this hour. What are your biggest questions about the economy? What are you hopeful about? What gives you a little bit of pause? Hey, give us a call. 888-477-9499. You can also email studio2 at whyy.org. If you're on YouTube or Facebook, hello. Drop a comment in the chat.
First, the trio of local news stories, Avi, and some breaking news this morning. Pennsylvania's ban on public funding for abortion is unconstitutional. This according to a ruling that came out this morning from Pennsylvania Commonwealth Court. So in a 4-3 decision, the court says the state constitution recognizes a, quote, fundamental right to reproductive autonomy. Now, there's sure to be an appeal to the state Supreme Court here, which does have the final say on Pennsylvania law. And the case had centered essentially on if state Medicaid funding can be used to pay for abortion. That had been outlawed. Writing for the majority, Judge Matthew Wolf said the decision was necessary to restrict government attempts to coerce reproductive choice. And in the dissent, Republican Patricia McCullough said the process in the case had been, quote, short-circuited, and said the court needed to hear more evidence.
And this all stems from a lawsuit, Kevin, tracking back to 2019.
Yeah.
What's interesting about that to me is that the lawsuit was filed before the overturning of Roe versus Wade,
right,
the U.S. Supreme Court. But since it's been filed, obviously it's taken on new meaning because we now are in a world where states have further license to restrict abortion access. And part of what's potentially at stake here is whether or not there's a backstop in the Pennsylvania Constitution that would restrict the state from further restricting abortion access. Let's imagine a future scenario where Republicans have a governmental trifecta. They attempt to do that. Would they be violating the state constitution? Now, a lot to sort out here. We still truly don't know. But this is one ruling in perhaps establishing that precedent. And it all goes back to something, Kevin, called the Equal Rights Amendment, which is in the Pennsylvania Constitution. And it's a very, very, I can read the whole thing here. It's very short. It says, equality of rights under the law shall not be denied or abridged in the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania because of the sex of the individual. Part of what's at issue here is whether that phrase there,
right,
is a constitutional guarantee to abortion access in Pennsylvania. And again, we still don't know, but this is perhaps a pivotal ruling on the path to finding out.
The argument being made there that women are the ones who would get abortions, and if you have a law that's prohibiting that,
it's unequal.
There's an unequal thing going on there. So we will, like we mentioned, this will get appealed to the state Supreme Court. The Attorney General of Pennsylvania, Dave Sunday, is a Republican. He will most certainly file an appeal to continue this case further, and we'll see where it goes.
Absolutely. Staying in politics now, the world of politics. So politicians from Josh Shapiro to Bernie Sanders are rallying behind a Lehigh Valley Democrat with a working class background, hoping he can flip a crucial Pennsylvania House seat. But, and stop me if this sounds familiar, he's got some old social media posts that are raising some eyebrows. So the candidate's name is Bob Brooks. He's a firefighter and union leader, the type of candidate Dems have been desperately trying to recruit as they struggle to win back white working class voters. According to the Washington Post, Brooks also made Facebook posts defending police after the George Floyd murder, calling Colin Kaepernick a D-bag, I'm cleaning that up a little bit, and also after a mass shooting in El Paso, Brooks shared a pro-gun meme affiliated with a right-wing militia group. Now, Brooks told the Washington Post he regretted that last post and didn't know anything about the militia group, but he also added that, quote, a bunch of D.C. insiders who don't want more working people in office were conspiring against him by digging up these old posts, which all date from over 5 years ago. Another interesting tidbit here, or at least it was interesting to me. A lot of the folks that endorsed this guy, Bob Brooks, were reportedly aware of the Facebook posts, including Governor Josh Shapiro, but also the left-wing Working Families Party. So that to me was, I don't imagine that would have been the case maybe 5 or 10 years ago. Maybe I'm wrong about that, but the fact that they knew and they probably knew this was going to come out and they endorsed him anyways was notable to me.
Well, I mean, I think we've been talking since the 2024 election about what lessons will Democrats learn. And we'll see. We've been waiting to see how that plays out. I think this and the Graham Plattner race in Maine are two instances where we're seeing the party maybe trying to get rid of some of those quote-unquote purity tests that they were often accused of, you know, in implementing and making candidates essentially that are kind of like grown in a lab that appeal to a very specific type of Democratic voter. And here is like a classic purple swing district where it's flipped back and forth between Democrat and Republican several times in the past decade. And the party is saying we need somebody here who can really reach out across to people that the president has been winning, and we need to win some of those folks back. And they think that this is the guy.
And, also of note, when the Washington Post published this story, it came out this morning, they quoted some Democrats responding to it, none of whom expressed any regret for backing this guy, Bob Brooks. That also tells you something, as you said, about sort of where the party maybe thinks it's heading. And I'm curious whether the Democratic voters will yank them back the other direction in this primary, because Brooks has serious opponents in this primary. Now, he's got a lot of the backing of the big names. We said Shapiro, we said Sanders, we said the Working Families Party. A lot of folks have rallied around him, but the voters have the final say.
Primary's coming up, Avi. Story number three.
Story number three. We wanted to take a moment to acknowledge a man that you probably never saw, but almost certainly heard. Scott R. Sanders, Philly's voice over king.
Make a deal, bring a trade, anything to move him out. Super Low Ford. They're the heroes we read about, the men and women we honor. Their stories helped change a nation. Ever wonder what to do with that old sports gear in the garage? I did until I heard about Second Time Around.
We'll be right back with more Boy Girl, Boy Girl on Cartoon Network.
So that is the voice of Scott Sanders. He died earlier this month. There's a really nice obituary of his life in the Enquirer. As you heard there at the end, Sanders was the guy who did a lot of the coming up next spots on Cartoon Network. If you grew up with Cartoon Network, he did tons of local radio ads for businesses, including the Enquirer. And he was really, really known for doing political advertisements. This is an amazing stat. In 1994 alone, Scott Sanders recorded almost 800 political ads for 90 different candidates. He was especially well known for his work doing attack ads. And in fact, he was so ubiquitous that The New Yorker actually profiled him. And he told the magazine that during his busiest months during an election season, he might record 25 to 30 political spots a day. Political pundits, insiders, the people who make these ads absolutely love this guy, Scott Sanders. I had not heard of him before reading this obituary, but as you can hear, he had one heck of a voice.
Yeah, lovely write-up by the Enquirer. Nice to see them do that. And it just kind of got me thinking, like, between, you know, NFL Films' John Facenda, right, Harry Callis, Terry Gross. There's something in the Schuylkill Punch that's making these classic voices in our region,
well,
right?
Well, throw Kevin McCrory in there. Why not? Do you like your voice, Kevin?
Sure.
Yeah, I like your voice. Honestly, I do.
I like your voice too.
I don't like my own voice. Maybe it's a grass is always greener thing, but I love the rasp in your voice. Anyways, it is interesting about sort of the idea of what makes sort of a good, because he goes into depth in this New Yorker piece about what this guy Scott Sanders tried to channel when he was voicing these political ads. And he said it was supposed to be like the doubting voice in your head, which is not a voice that screams. It's not a voice that's angry. It's a voice that's sort of like quietly indignant. And so I thought that was a fascinating insight into what makes kind of a negative political ad stand out from the competition.
Yeah. Amazing what goes into these things and how somebody who just becomes popular all of a sudden, that's the name and that everybody goes to them. And it was great to see the Enquirer do that roundup. We are talking about the economy today on the show in our main segment. We've got a couple great guests in, including Patrick Harker, who's the former Philly Fed Reserve chair here locally for the local branch. So it's always great to get his insights on the economy and how everything is
and
going.
And the former president of the University of Delaware, by the way.
Oh,
shout out Blue Hens.
Did not know that.
That doesn't make the top line of his bio anymore, and I feel like it should. Look, it's 420. We're going to talk about grain. We want to know, what is your big question about the economy? What are your biggest hopes? What are your biggest fears? Give us a call, 888-477-9499. You can email studio2@whyy.org. If you're on YouTube or Facebook, drop a comment in the chat, and don't go anywhere. This is Studio 2.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine is helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at pennmedicine.org/cancer.
And welcome back, everybody, to Studio 2 here at WHYY. I'm Avi Wolfman-Arendt.
And I'm Kevin McCrory in for Cherry Gregg. Inflation has dogged the U.S. economy for years. Add to that the Iran war, supply chain chaos, and soaring fuel prices, and it's no surprise that consumer sentiment about the economy just hit an all-time low.
But are we heading to a recession? Is it just a rough patch? President Donald Trump says neither. He points to a strong stock market and continues to call for interest rate cuts. And if his Fed chair nominee clears a Senate Banking Committee hearing tomorrow, Trump might get those cuts.
Unpacking it all with us this hour, we have two great guests. Patrick Harker is the former president of the Federal Reserve Bank in Philadelphia. He's now a professor at the Wharton School. Welcome.
Thank you.
And by Zoom, we have Lydia DePillis, economics reporter for The New York Times. Great to have you with us, Lydia.
Good to see you guys.
And we'd love to hear from you this hour. What are your biggest questions about the economy? Are you hopeful? Are you fearful? About what? Give us a call, 888-477-9499. You can email studio2@whyy.org. If you're watching on YouTube or Facebook, go ahead and drop a comment in the chat.
Let's start with the war in Iran. You know, the old adage is uncertainty is going to mean trouble for the stock market. But we're seeing the opposite. We have all this uncertainty. We have the blockade. We have, you know, questions over how long this war will last. Yet the stock market keeps going up. Patrick Harker, what's going on here?
Oh, thanks for having me. First of all, there are two markets. There's a stock market and then there's the bond market. And those two have started to spread apart. They're not behaving as they normally behave. I actually think of the bond traders as the adults in the room. That irritates some of my friends who are the equities traders, as you can imagine. But watch that market. There's a lot of euphoria in the stock market. A lot of it is really based on AI. That's what's driving the market right now, is AI. And they're betting on AI having a very significant productivity boost, in the economy.
Despite what's happening in the world global
order. That's what they're betting on, basically. I mean, it's more complicated than that. Life is more complicated than that.
You're essentializing
but
a little bit.
But essentially, that's it. But the bond market has not responded in the same way.
Explain the bond market to folks and what it says about the economy, what it's doing right now, real quick.
So it is keeping rates high. I mean, the bond market, very simply, is if you buy bonds like treasury bonds, 10-year treasury bonds, if you pay a lot for it, the interest rate goes down. If you pay less, the interest rate goes up, right? So you're buying a $100 bond, and that's what happens. So what you're seeing right now is the long end of the yield curve, as it's called, is staying up there.
Yep.
It's not coming down. And I don't think it's going to be coming down anytime soon, and we can get into that.
And so that means some people are queasy about the future of the economy.
That inflation's going to remain high. That's one bet. And the other is that we're pumping the market full of debt with the treasuries, that is with our deficit that we're running. All those things are factoring into keeping those long end interest rates high.
And there's some theory out there that, you know, the financial system has been bailed out before, that Trump, you know, essentially always kind of caves to what the market does. So there's going to be some return to normalcy, and that maybe that's kind of priced in the thinking on Wall Street, so that they think it's not going to get that bad. No one's going to actually let it get that bad. So in the meantime, we can continue trading as if things are soaring.
And we know through history that all works until it doesn't, right? And when it doesn't...
Wait, so is it 1929 right now?
No. Okay, but okay. When it doesn't, it happens fast, yeah. Right?
Let me bring in Lydia DePillis, and I want to read this comment from our listener, John, who said, just wanted to add in the maxim that's always repeated on Marketplace. We love Marketplace, by the way. Support your local public media. And that maxim is, the stock market is not the economy. Lydia, do you agree? Is this a good time to remember the stock market is not the economy? Or maybe is the stock market telling us to be a little more optimistic than consumers?
Yeah. I mean, I think it is and it isn't, right? So it isn't in that it's sort of untethered from economic fundamentals, as Patrick was saying, right? Like, we also have a very deeply slow job market and inflation that's sort of stubborn and persistent. And a lot of these other risks that are out there that could lead to some kind of more significant breakdown. The way then in which it is a little bit is that more and more people do own stocks, and right. Wealth is what is powering a lot of consumption. So when you've heard the term K-shaped economy, and like, we shouldn't overplay the degree to which that exists any more so than it always has. But like, at this moment, it is true that high income earners are feeling really good. Their home prices are very high. Their stock portfolios have just continued breaking records. And so that is feeding into an optimistic mentality that keeps prompting them to take vacations or buy that new car. And that's the kind of thing that is somewhat resistant to these underlying economic fundamentals, as long as the stock market continues to do okay.
And if I could add to that, sure. Though, one of the issues I have is really the fragility of the economy. I mean, we're looking at an economy that on the surface looks good,
yeah. But
it's fragile. Go to that point that was just made. The top 10% of the income distribution, that constitutes 50% of consumer expenditure. And consumer expenditure is 70% of U.S. GDP.
Wealthy people are spending a lot of money right now.
That 10% constitutes 35% of U.S. GDP. Mm. If they get skittish, if the markets start to correct in a major way, that consumer spending stops. And
because
that
their
could
money,
put us into a recession.
Because their wealth is fueled by the stock market.
Yeah,
rising.
And housing prices and other assets. But that's fragile, right? I mean, they get skittish and things can turn bad.
Lydia, we've been teasing the fact that this University of Michigan study came out last week and said that consumer confidence is an all-time low. Could you unpack that further? What's happening to the American household that's not in that top 10%?
Yeah. I mean, so that measure is an important and long-running series that we need to take into account. There's other series, so I wouldn't overplay it. We can't definitively say that everyone's in the worst mood they've ever been in ever.
Right.
But I do think it's a little bit simple. It has a lot to do with gas prices. And when gas prices spike, people get really grumpy because it is the thing that, probably more Americans notice and depend on than any other one kind of price or metric. And that just was the undeniable marker that this war is affecting their everyday lives. But, other things are happening too, right? It's really hard to get a job right now, even though most people who want jobs have jobs. If you want to switch jobs or you're locked out of the job market, it's really hard to get back in. If you are just entering the job market as a young person, you're, in a really tough position. So there's all kinds of things that are making the sort of mass share of the population a little bit grumpy right now. And it is untethered from those very frothy equity markets.
Mm-hmm. Our question for you this hour, what are your biggest questions about the economy? What are you hopeful about in the economy? What kind of scares you right now? Give us a call, 888-477-9499. You can email studio2@whyy.org, YouTube, Facebook, drop a comment in the chat. This is a comment from Gene in Haddon Township, who says, how has the decrease in the percentage of people who own stock affected the market? First of all, let's talk about the premise of that question, Patrick, but also you were talking earlier about how people's personal investments in the state of the stock market are actually important to the fundamentals of the economy.
Absolutely.
Right now. So let's just address Gene's question real quick.
So first of all, we, the boomers, I'm a boomer, we're aging, and there's one thing that's sure, it's sure in our lives, we're not going to be here forever. And so we're starting to peak, our generation's starting to peak. And that is the largest generation with the largest wealth that is going into retirement in this country. But what you do in retirement is you start to spend some of that money.
Right,
right. So you're going to start to see that unwind over time. The stock market, I agree. I don't think this is a perfect measure of the health of the economy, as I said earlier, with the bond market. And yeah, there's people are continuing to hold on. A certain percentage of Americans are holding on to a stock portfolio. But you look at the numbers, a significant number of Americans, a very large number, have no savings for retirement. So they can't be holding stock,
right?
As a result, they are the people who are feeling, and I like the word grumpy. We have a very grumpy populace. We have a very grumpy economy, and you can understand why. AI is taking away, for some professions, the bottom rung of the career ladder. They can't, so their kids go to college and they're not getting that job. They are afraid of switching jobs, as we were talking about. They're seeing the gas price smack them in the face every time they go down the street. It's the one good where we see that price every day. And you're starting to see this trickle into the economy. This is not just a one-off. People understand it. Amazon just announced a 3.5% surcharge for third-party sellers. You're going to start to see this just trickle in, trickle in, trickle in.
But and should they be historically grumpy, I think, is kind of the question, Patrick. Because, look, we could go back to the stagflation of the 70s. We could look at, there's plenty of crisis points in the history of the American economy. And it is interesting, at least to me, that we're talking about sort of historically sour attitudes. And this is a survey that goes back many, many, many decades.
74 years.
Yeah. I mean, does that make sense to you, Patrick Harker?
Yeah. So there's also the Consumer Confidence Index the Conference Board puts out. There are a lot of indices that you can look at. And none of them perfectly correlate with what actually happens in the economy. Sure. I think we should be clear about that. But all these factors are combining on the American populace, right? They've had inflation above 2%. They've been feeling this. They go to the grocery store. This has been long running now. It's not just a one-off. It's not just the war. So that they've been living with that and trying to make ends meet. And then they get whacked with these energy prices that'll, again, trickle into other goods and services. And they're afraid for their kids being able to get jobs. I mean, they were told, send your kid to college, scrape, you know, work hard to try to get your kid to college. And now is AI taking those jobs away? All these factors are really weighing on the American
anxiety.
Mind.
Yeah, let's talk more about the AI of it all. You mentioned how much that's propping up the stock market right now. And you also said it's not 1929, but when I see a company like Allbirds that made shoes rebrand itself as an AI company last week, I'm thinking, have we jumped the shark here? Like, is this the dot-com bubble all over again?
Yeah.
Do you have thoughts on that, Patrick?
So let's go back, if we could, just a little bit in economic history. This is not a new cycle. We've seen these cycles before, right? Electricity came in. Lots of people got excited about electricity. Firms went bust. Other people picked up the pieces, figured out how to use it over time. It takes time to change production processes. We built a lot of fiber in the 90s. We laid a lot of fiber across the world. A lot of those companies went bust. We picked up the pieces, and then we went on. Railroads. We could just cycle after cycle the technology. So you have to believe, some people do, that this technology is so radically different than anything we've ever seen before that it's not going to turn out that way. I don't buy that. I think it is a new technology. It is a transformative technology. So is electricity. And we're going to go through the same kind of cycle. There will be a bust. There's going to be a boom. There's going to be a bust. People will pick up the pieces. I can't tell you which. If I knew which firms were going to bust, I wouldn't be sitting here right now.
You'd be day trading right now. I got that. Yeah.
But that's going to be the trend.
Yeah.
Now, I don't think it's going to be horrible. I don't think it's going to be 1929. I'm not even sure it's going to be the dot-com bust. But we're going to go through that cycle. Mm. Sure.
Lydia, do you have a take on that based on your reporting?
No, I mean, you know, one aspect of the AI boom and maybe bust is that, you know, yes, a lot of it is in public markets, and that's been fueling the big run up over the past couple of years. But a lot of it is in private markets, mm-hmm. right? So you see these private credit firms lending in huge amounts, and even suppliers lending to their customers. And the, you know, question that's been hotly debated in sort of financial circles is how insulated that is from the rest of the economy. Yeah. Like, if and when this stuff does see some sort of collapse, is that systemic? Is it going to infect other parts of the financial system? it seems like maybe not. It's not quite big enough. It's like walled off enough that it won't necessarily do that. But, you know, there are linkages that we don't always predict. And that's what I'm kind of nervous about as we watch this evolution of this.
Yeah, and the Fed's watching that very carefully, the private markets and private credit markets. It is not where it's creating a systemic risk for the economy. As you just heard, it's not big enough. However, there are signs that there's trouble. I'll give you one example. So I was at an event recently, and a guy who was in this space, an investor, said his father, a retired dentist, got an unsolicited mailing to invest in a private credit fund. That's kind of when you know it's hit its peak, right? When they're soliciting the retired dentist, that should give you some pause.
Well, because that means they're looking wide for investors.
Yeah.
They're trying to, and maybe that's because there's a shortage of investors where they would traditionally.
No, there's still people putting money into private credit, but they've gotten to the size where they have to deploy so much every year, and they need to feed the beast, right? They need to feed the machine.
Is that not like a Ponzi scheme sort of at its base, or am I way off here?
No, I don't think it's a Ponzi scheme, but it,
just want to make sure.
The early people into any market, they understand it, they know the risk, they manage them well.
Yeah.
But then more and more people get in, and we saw that with mortgages.
Yeah, Lydia, you were trying to jump in there, just curious for your thoughts.
Yeah, just a quick note on that, because, I mean, Patrick is totally right. They're trying to find new customers, and one way they're doing that is changing the rules so that this stuff can go in your 401k. Mm-hmm. And I'm not exactly sure how that's going to play out in terms of like how you opt in or out, but Americans' retirement funds are like multi-trillion-dollar market. And, you know, that before was very difficult to do because this is a highly regulated financial asset. But if that is able to flow into private equity and private credit funds, and as it soon will be, that means that you could be affected even without knowing it.
Yeah, just to zoom out a little bit, a year ago today, we might have been talking about tariffs and how tariffs were going to potentially cause, calamitous impact on the economy. I feel like that conversation somewhat has receded. I mean, a lot of those things have been negotiated. They've been up, they've been down, they've been back, they've been forth. It's kind of whiplash. Do you have a sense of, is there something different happening now on that topic? And is it different than you would have thought of?
So the Supreme Court weighed in, of course. We don't know whether we're going to get rebates or not, or who's going to get the rebates. All that's hanging out there. But the tariff issue is still there. It's still trickling through the economy in various ways. But companies learn to adapt, right? This is what company leaders want. They just want certainty. Tell us what the rules are, and then leave us alone, and we'll figure it out, right? Whatever those rules are. What was killing them early on with the tariffs was it kept changing every single day. That's very difficult to manage. So, no, the tariffs are still there. There's still the threat of more tariffs. But right now, it's not obviously the headline event.
We are encouraging you to ask your big questions about the economy this hour. Give us a call, 888-477-9499. You can email studio2@whyy.org, YouTube, Facebook, drop a comment in the chat. I love this question from Trish in Newport, Delaware. This is what Trish says. When Obama was president, economists kept saying we need 150,000 new jobs a month to accommodate unemployed people. Where did that narrative go? I'm giving that to you, Lydia, because you have written extensively on this weird situation where job growth is sluggish, but unemployment remains low. What the heck is going on, Lydia?
So glad for that question, Trish. Yeah, it can be really unnerving to see job growth in the like 20s or 30s or negative. It's actually gone from negative to positive to negative to positive for the past like better part of a year. And that reflects the fact that we are not generating workers at the same rate that we did in the Obama years. And it's like always good to not attach yourself to that raw number because like coming out of the pandemic, right, we saw 400,000 jobs a month, and that was because we were adding back
what
20
lost.
Million jobs over the course of a couple of years. So focus less on the raw numbers and more on the unemployment rate. That's like the really key metric here. And so anyway, long way of saying, the reason that it's so low these days is because we have cut off many avenues to immigration. There was a huge immigration surge on top of those added back jobs in 22, 23, and 24. We've essentially cut that off and are now, as I'm sure everyone is aware, deporting, thousands of people a month. And that has taken a real toll on the labor supply. demand for labor has sunk at the same time, which is why you're not seeing the unemployment rate sink a ton.
So are these like two unrelated things that just happen to be lining up right now? It's almost this weird coincidence, Lydia?
So sort of. I mean, they are both policy driven, right?
Right.
Like the immigration flow is a choice made by the White House, and the labor demand is partly just sort of a hangover from the post-pandemic years when maybe some firms overhired. They just don't need any more people. And partly is that tariff-driven and policy-driven uncertainty that Patrick mentioned. It's like a lot of folks, a lot of companies just didn't want to commit to hiring more people when they didn't know what their cash flow was going to look like the following month.
Lydia, just while we're talking about immigration, I think the premise of the Trump administration's policy there was that it would somehow help, you know, the Native American worker, and their wages would go up, their opportunities would increase. Have we seen any evidence of that so far?
Yeah. So in the short term, I would say it has helped keep unemployment low in a raw sense and maybe bolstered wages a little bit. We still have fairly healthy wage growth. Over the long term, many studies have shown over the years that restricting immigration to this degree can decrease productivity in the economy because immigrants tend to be a complementary labor force to Americans, right? So like folks who are coming in, they maybe don't have a ton of education, they work in home health care or in construction and enable jobs for Americans who have maybe more education, more cultural fluency and opportunities to have jobs at all. And not to mention the fact, I mean, on the home health care front, this is a demand for people that is not going to be supplied domestically. It just do not have the number of people graduating from high school that we would need to supply this demand. So over the long term, it's like not necessarily all that good for Americans, even though in the short term, maybe there's some beneficial effect.
Darren asked us a question sort of about personal economy. I'm hoping you could tackle this one, Pat. What will happen to the economy if people don't pay off their credit cards? First of all, I guess I'll add to that. Are there signs that there's sort of like there's economic crisis within sort of the individual household level that could turn into something worse for the broader economy? And then I guess directly addressing Darren's question about what happens if people don't.
Yeah, so this adds on to my sense of fragility in the economy. Yeah. If you look at measures of auto loan delinquencies, credit card delinquencies, they've not reached crisis level, but they are creeping up. Mm. And we know that. It makes common sense, right? That the people who are at the lower to mid-level of the income distribution are barely getting by, right? They're barely making their house payment and their car payment and the credit card payment. So not paying off your credit card, of course, really severely damages the individual and the family, right? It just, that's a not a good news story. But it's usually the thing that people do first because they need their house, they need their car, right? And so this is the early sign that things are not as good as the headline numbers would say.
We're talking this hour with Patrick Harker, the former president of the Federal Reserve Bank in Philadelphia, and also New York Times economics reporter Lydia DePillis. Lydia, tomorrow we have a Fed chair confirmation hearing scheduled in D.C. Can you tell us about the context there? Who is Kevin Warsh? What's he about? What's this hold up in the Senate committee about?
So, yeah, Kevin Warsh is a former Fed governor, so he's well known to the members, and he was considered a fairly middle of the road pick who might have a little bit of independence from the president. He has been saying in recent years that he favors lowering interest rates for his own reasons. He has justifications for that coincidentally line up with the president's priorities. He's been held up for, I mean, his appointment or his nomination was a couple of months ago now. And a key senator on that committee, Tom Tillis, said that he would not vote to advance Warsh until the White House and the Justice Department withdrew a case that they have made against Fed Chair Jerome Powell having to do with renovations of the Fed headquarters, an indictment saying that it was excessive and maybe criminal. So like judges have found that to be hard to believe, but the Justice Department has appealed. And so the president may have sabotaged himself in that way because it has delayed this confirmation. Chair Powell's term is ending, but he will stay on if Warsh isn't confirmed. So long, convoluted story here, but we are going to have a hearing tomorrow, so we'll see what goes.
And I guess just to put the basics out there, Jerome Powell has been the head of the Fed since 2018. His term is set to expire May 15th. President Trump has wanted him to slash interest rates. He has kind of, you know, held as a bulwark against that. And now this new pick, Kevin Warsh, is expected to, you know, do more in line with what the president would like to see.
Right. So, first of all, the president believes that the Fed chair gets their way all the time.
Right.
Not true. The FOMC, I was part of that. He is one, or she is one of 19 members. Obviously, with a very large presence in the room. But he's one of 19. And so he has to move, or she has to move the committee. First of all, Jay's term ends as chair of the Board of Governors. He can stay on as a governor.
Right.
Whether he will or not is an open question, but he could, which would mean the president only gets one slot to fill. That means the committee doesn't change that much. And so you can't see a new chair coming in and just radically changing things. The Fed is an institution. And yes, the individual can shape the institution, but the institution always shapes the individual as well.
What would be your questions for Kevin Warsh, Patrick Harker, if you had a chance to be a part of this confirmation hearing? What would you want to hear from him?
So I'm not so worried about the monetary policy side. I think Kevin, I understand his views. I mean, some of what he said doesn't make perfect sense, that he wants to lower rates and also shrink the balance sheet very dramatically. We won't get into that. That's a technical issue. That doesn't make a whole lot of sense. There's a discontinuity there. It's more on the regulatory side that where I think, because the Fed governors also have a role in setting regulations for the financial institutions, the banks in this country. And I think more of my questions would be around that and making sure that the banks remain safe and sound.
Because you're worried he would loosen those regulations and that the banks could do what they did leading up to the
financial
crisis.
Yeah, but here's the problem, right? And this is why it's complicated. It's like whack-a-mole. So you tighten regulations on the banks, and then the shadow banking sector, the private equity sector, what we were just talking about, it rises up.
Mm-hmm.
So how is he going to manage all that to reduce the risk to the economy?
Do you have concerns about his specific policies in that area, or is that just an overarching question?
No, it's an overarching question for me.
What about the independence of the Fed? I mean, I think what a lot of folks on Capitol Hill are trying to determine right now is Kevin Warsh the guy from before the Trump era, he's been around much longer than Trump in the political sphere. Is he the guy that has these theories about the economy and that will be his guiding light? Or is he a guy that is trying to suck up to Trump and will be doing his bidding as chair?
I don't think Kevin's that kind of person. I actually think Kevin's going to be the chair of the Federal Reserve Board of Governors and the FOMC. He's not going to suck up to the president. Remember, these people last far beyond an individual president. That's why there's a 14-year term. I mean, they go over multiple administrations. So, no, I don't see Kevin just kowtowing to whatever the administration wants. It's not him.
But he certainly is a departure from Jerome Powell's way of doing business. And as I understand it, he was, he was a governor under Ben Bernanke, and he disagreed with some of what Bernanke did coming out of the Great Recession. Could you just help people understand, what are the different sides of the monetary policy debate that I'm sure most people don't think about?
The 19 people in that room will disagree with each other, right? But at some point, they've got to act on behalf of the American people, and they do. So, yeah, he's going to have disagreements. They have disagreements today. That doesn't mean that the FOMC becomes dysfunctional. Absolutely not.
I want to read this comment from Lookabear on YouTube, who says, "I don't understand the stock market no matter how much I research it. I mean, it's all made up anyways." Lydia, I would love for you to talk to Lookabear and all the people out there who are just very confused about the state of the stock market. We gave one possible reason, which is that AI is driving an investor frenzy, but aren't there other things that are contributing to the rise in the stock market? For instance, I know corporate earnings are very high right now. Are there other things out there that are fueling investor confidence that could explain to someone like Lookabear why there seems to be this disconnect?
Yeah, well, look, a bear. I mean, I would not try to read any logic into movements in the stock market. I see, you know, CNBC say, well, stocks rose on this news today and sank on that. There's a lot of momentum in equity markets where you have traders saying, like, I don't want to miss out on this trade, yeah. So I'm going to pile in, right? So there's partly there's that. But as you mentioned, corporate earnings are looking really good and consumer spending has held up. Also, there's a lot of Patrick mentioned this whole question around regulation. That is something that corporations really do like and see profit opportunities in. They've also gotten a big tax break. So, you know, for investment right now, you can, you know, there's immediate expensing and like stuff like that, that is saving companies a lot of money. Plus the AI that we mentioned. I mean, so either there's a huge productivity boom and those valuations are worth it, or there's not, and maybe there's a crash. But it's certainly not one thing. I mean, also, like, the U.S. is looking better than most countries out there.
Can we talk about that for a second? Because, you know, I want to read this. This is like a lead in a Wall Street Journal story from earlier this month. In the past year, the U.S. economy has seemed to defy gravity, withstanding a chaotic trade war, shocks of labor supply, and wild swings in the stock market. Now it is absorbing a global oil shock far better than most of the world. Are we just lucky, Lydia? Is this something? Does this saying something about the American economy that it's maybe actually pretty darn well positioned? How do you explain all the things just laid out in that lead?
Yeah, I mean, the investor notes that I have read this just this morning are reflecting back on Liberation Day, right? Like that day that Trump declared gigantic tariffs on the rest of the world. And there was almost a 20% dip and then a very fast, robust rebound. And so there, you know, investors are thinking about that and like seeing this episode in the same light. But the thing about tariffs is that it was very much just subject to presidential decision making. And what happened was he softened a bunch of the tariffs as he saw markets wobbling. And so they didn't have the impact that was feared, in part because they were not as big as was feared. This episode is different in that the president is no longer fully in control. Like, a lot of infrastructure in the Gulf has been destroyed. So that's going to have ramifications for a long time.
You can't
time.
Just pull it back unilaterally is kind of what you're
exactly.
saying. But are we defying gravity here? I'm just curious, Lydia. Are we defying gravity?
It's hard to say. I mean, but I think that the U.S. economy is very well set up to do well through these kinds of difficult times. For example, just take one thing, natural gas, right? Like, we do produce a lot of that right now. And oil is a worldwide market, so those prices do affect prices at the pump. But natural gas is less so. It's less easily tradable. So the fact that we produce a lot of it means that we have not seen the kinds of utility price spikes that Europe is experiencing.
But real quick, as we get ready to wrap up in about 45 seconds, Patrick, with a nod to the folks at Wicked, are we defying gravity right now? Is gravity coming for the U.S. economy?
The American economy is forever amazes me. It's very resilient.
Yeah.
And one thing we can do is we pivot, we change, we can adapt very quickly compared to other countries. And I think that is kind of our superpower.
Yeah. Well, you guys have filled us with all sorts of knowledge. I feel like I have a superpower right now. Patrick Harker, former president of the Federal Reserve Bank of Philadelphia, professor at the Wharton School, former president at the University of Delaware. I'm sneaking that in there, Pat. Thank you so much for your time today on Studio 2. And also let me thank Lydia DePillis, economics reporter for the New York Times. Lydia, appreciate you joining us on Studio 2 here at WHYY.
Our show today was produced by Debbie Bilder, Hazel Mae Bryan, and Paige Mary Bessler. Mike Schiffler is our visual producer. Al Banks and Tina Calique engineered the show. I'm executive producer Kevin McCory.
And from Studio 2 here at WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Avi Wolfman-Arendt. We will talk to you tomorrow.